Chapter 16. Howard of Afghanistan. The press had no pictures of Howard Hart. They didn't even know his name. The few congressmen on the intelligence committees who had met him had received only the most general briefings. Not even the State Department was aware of how he ran his operation. No one in the Islamabad embassy, where the station was housed, dreamed of asking him what he was doing. Strangest of all, only a very small group of people in the CIA knew the details of Hart's campaign. Although Hart and the CIA worked with many branches of the government and drew heavily on the Pentagon's support, no one attempted to dictate to the station chief what tactical decisions he should be making in the most sensitive of covert wars against the Red Army. No one but Charlie Wilson. That was why Hart reacted so badly when news of Wilson's $40 million legislative gift reached him at the station in Islamabad. Charlie had innocently assumed that the CIA would appreciate what he had just done. After all, Tip O'Neill and his House Democrats were virtually at war with the agency. They had just cut off all funding for the Contras, and the last thing any of the agency's leaders expected from that same Congress was a $40 million appropriation earmarked for secret warfare in Afghanistan. It was an enormous sum for those days, $10 million more than the entire U.S. contribution to the Mujahideen the year before. But to Wilson's dismay, no one at the agency seemed to appreciate the gesture, least of all Howard Hart. Case officers are different from most people. They're trained to be paranoid. Their job is to identify and evaluate threats, and the one thing Hart could spot from a mile away was a first-class challenge to his command. To him, Wilson's Erlikon maneuver was nothing short of a direct slap in the face. Yet that was precisely what Wilson had just done with the bill that he had somehow gotten through Congress. Taken literally, the legislation virtually ordered the CIA to deploy an anti-aircraft cannon in Afghanistan, and Hart quickly determined that the only weapon that fit the congressman's specifications and that made sense for the CIA to buy was the Swiss Erlikon. It was definitely not a Soviet weapon, and if Wilson was going to force Hart to put this big Western gun into the war zone, he might just as well write CIA in neon letters all over it. In fact, in one fell swoop, this extraordinarily meddlesome congressman was threatening to upend the inflexible Cold War rule that the American hand never be displayed in a proxy war. In retrospect, the CIA's efforts to conceal its role in those early years of the Afghan War seem extreme. Only Soviet weapons that the Afghans themselves could have captured or acquired were allowed into the agency's pipeline. U.S. Air Force planes would then fly the CIA's war goods to Saudi Arabia, where they would be unloaded, repackaged, and flown to Pakistan on Saudi cargo planes. Additional weapons and ammunition came by ship. Pakistani intelligence agents, not Americans, passed the weapons on to the Mujahideen. Even the satellite targeting studies drawn up in Washington for the freedom fighters were translated into primitive hand-drawn pictures so that they looked as if they were the work of an Afghan scout. Hart had another reason beyond knee-jerk dogma for worrying about the consequences of introducing Wilson's Erlikons into the war zone. Over the long years of the Cold War, a kind of unwritten understanding had emerged between the superpowers about rules of engagement in proxy wars. The implicit understanding in Afghanistan was that the United States would not taunt the Soviets with an overt demonstration of involvement. That, at least, was the way Hart and his CIA colleagues saw it. Of course, it was an open secret that the CIA was arming the Mujahideen, but no one admitted it, and the voluntary discipline of concealment engendered a certain restraint. As long as the United States observed this self-restraint, Hart and the CIA high command assumed the Soviets would also refrain from upping the ante. Hart's very specific fear about the Erlikons was that the expensive Swiss automatic cannons would startle and anger the Kremlin and cause it to reevaluate its entire war strategy. If the Red Army were to move with 1 million troops, or even only 500,000, instead of its current force level of 120,000, it could break the resistance, Hart believed, and then the Soviets would surely move on Pakistan. Under this scenario, the Red Army wouldn't even need to invade. With tens of thousands of troops on the frontier, there would be endless ways to make life hellish for Zia: cross-border raids, sabotage of CIA arms depots, stirring up of trouble among the 3 million Afghan refugees. Bombings and assassinations were already plaguing the refugee world in the northwest frontier, and Hart could see how easily things could rage out of control if the Soviets ever decided to go for broke. Would the United States be prepared to send American boys to defend Zia-ul-Haq, the man who'd murdered Benazir Bhutto's father, the dictator, building an Islamic bomb? All these thoughts and more were running through his head as he sat down with his paramilitary expert and composed a return cable to headquarters, attempting to explain why it would be lunacy for the CIA to buy the Swiss gun. For starters, the weapon was incredibly heavy, requiring at least 3 mules to transport it. On top of that, each round cost upwards of $50, and firing at a rate of several hundred rounds a minute, the Oerlikon would eat up a 60-round magazine in a matter of seconds. How could the agency move all that ammunition through the mountains to keep such a gun in action? And how could the Oerlikon be used except in one fixed location? Guerrillas were supposed to be mobile. Hart suggested that even his counterpart in Pakistan intelligence, General Akhtar, shared his reasoning. When the cable reached Langley, Cogan and Deputy Director John McMahon embraced its conclusions. But what moved them to join Hart in resisting the Oerlikon had less to do with the gun's limitations than it did with the underlying principle to which Hart needed only allude. The station chief's coded red alert had come through loud and clear. This was a test case that went beyond the immediate danger of testing the Soviets with the Oerlikon. Wilson's bill was challenging the CIA's historic right to run its own operations. The agency's professionals had long since become accustomed to congressional efforts to close down operations or to investigate supposed excesses. But this move of Wilson's to force the agency to be more provocatively aggressive blindsided everyone. Hart and Cogan had assumed they could wait out Wilson and he would eventually go away. Instead, he had simply bullied his way into their poker game, and now, with his $40 million appropriation on the books, was directing them to do something that they claimed was madness. They had little choice but to try to reason with him. The problem Hart and the other CIA officials had in talking to Wilson in those days was that they had such radically different notions about what would constitute a victory in Afghanistan. Hart never had trouble explaining the logic behind his Afghan strategy to professionals like Lewis Stokes, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, or Daniel Patrick Moynihan, vice chair of the Senate Committee, when they came through Pakistan, wondering where the growing CIA campaign was going. He would always begin by explaining that even if they didn't quite see how it would all end, there were compelling reasons why the best scenario for the United States was simply more of the same. For starters, the CIA's analysts now believed that every dollar that the United States slipped into the insurrection cost the Soviets at least 10 to counter. That was the beauty of being on the right side of the guerrilla war. It's expensive to fight men who are not afraid to die. They just go around blasting hardware and soldiers without warning, bleeding the occupiers at will. There was another factor. The Soviets were not using their old weapons in Afghanistan. They were deploying frontline troops along with their most sophisticated Hind helicopters, MiG fighters, and T-72 tanks, men and machinery that otherwise would be committed to the European battlefield, where as many as 50 divisions of U.S. and Soviet troops sat eyeball to eyeball. Every ruble they spent and every soldier they committed to Afghanistan was one less available for the European front. Beyond that, the Pentagon was ecstatic with the war booty the CIA was capturing. Whatever the Soviets were using in Afghanistan was thought to offer a window into how the Red Army would fight when the big one broke out on the NATO frontier. The agency, on behalf of its military cousins, began offering the Mujahideen huge rewards for the capture of a Hind, and even more for a KGB communications van. $1 million was said to be the reward for one of these treasures, but the bounty was extravagant for all sorts of items. The Pentagon's Soviet analysts seemed to have an indiscriminate appetite for everything the 40th Army used: tanks, mines, recoilless rifles, flak jackets, medical kits. No one in the press, and certainly no one in the U.S. government, was talking about a victory in Afghanistan. In fact, all of the media accounts continued to portray the Afghans as heroic victims, doomed to be destroyed. But Howard Hart saw things differently. Now well into his third year as the CIA's field marshal, he felt that he was on the verge of pulling off a historic covert triumph. By that he didn't mean a conventional victory over the Red Army. The resistance was not only intact, contrary to almost all of the experts' predictions, it was now a genuine problem for the Soviets. Hart calculated that perhaps 400,000 Afghans had been armed in some fashion or other with CIA weapons. he would be the first to acknowledge that the Mujahideen were hardly an army. They were more like a rabble in arms. But what a rabble! The veteran of the Khomeini humiliation sometimes had to pinch himself at the thought of having hundreds of thousands of Muslim fanatics moving about Pakistan and the Hindu Kush, all living for the moment when they could aim their CIA weapons at a Soviet infidel.